With no further ado, I'm going to a change of industry.
Thank you. And I'm going to pass over to two colleagues. Firstly, to Malcolm Cook from First ScotRail, who's their simulator centre manager. And then I think we have a double act. I'll hand over back to Justin Willett, who is the head of training at National Express. So over to you, Malcolm.
Hello, good morning, everybody. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. It's my first time here, and I've personally learned an awful lot already today. From talking to you all, I've learned that the issues and barriers that we're facing in the rail industry are not unique. You've already encountered some of them, and you've gone through them. And it's really interesting to hear the things that you've got to say. There's good news and there's bad news. The bad news is that I'm responsible for that really wordy title for the presentation. The good news is that it's my job to get us through the preamble as quickly as possible so I can hand over to my co-presenter for the meat of the presentation. That's the Prince of Darkness over there. I'm sorry, Justin Willett from One Railway. Okay, I'm Malcolm Cook, as it says, Chairman of the Simulator User Group. Anybody who would like to understand a little bit more about how we use simulators in the rail industry, please contact me. There are, I'll show you how many simulators we've got in the rail industry, but, you know, I may be able to organise a trip, a visit to a local simulator to allow you to see how we do things on the front line. My background, it's not unique, although it is slightly different because it allows me to look at things from both sides of the fence. I was a career soldier, as you can see, very fortunate to spend a lot of time on armoured vehicles, doing loads of interesting stuff. Then I qualified as an army pilot. And the benefit of that was I got a little bit of human factors training thrown in for free. The downside is that once you do all these sort of good jobs, they say, right, well done, get on that desk. So they put me on a desk in the headquarters of Army Aviation as a training analyst. I found it surprisingly interesting, and it's actually the background to my subsequent career, which is with the railways. I'm a baby in the railways, and this will tell you a fair bit about the railway. I've been in the rail industry 9 years, and I'm still considered the new boy. Okay, so things change. I decided to leave the military because you get to the stage where if you want a second career, you've got to go now. And I chose the rail industry because I could see the similarities, and we'll look at that in a little while. Spent a couple of years driving trains in the same region as Justin. Then I went to Central Trains where they just installed a driving simulator. They didn't know what to do with it. They bought it, and I arrived in the room, and it was sitting in the middle of the room, wires and all. Please make this work. Things have moved on from there, and I'm now at ScotRail. What we're going to look at, introduction to the use of simulators in the rail industry. It will help you understand where we are and where we want to be. The similarities between aviation and military, not just aviation and military, but all safety-critical industries. What the differences are, though, these are the key problems that we face that I believe are almost unique to the rail industry. The challenges of bringing in a just culture, which Justin will elaborate on. What initiatives are being done, particularly with RSSB and Justin's National Express East Anglia. And what are the next steps? So, train driving simulators. They are not new in the UK. More than 20 years ago, we had very primitive train driving simulators. 10 years ago, we had one or two. Now we have an awful lot. And the reason why we have an awful lot is primarily down to Lord Cullen, saying that, you know, you really must get your training and competence management systems in order, and simulation was seen as a good way of doing it. That makes you think that the reason we brought simulation in is purely for driving competence and safety. Invariably, it was to win the franchise. Being brutally honest, you would not win a franchise in this country unless you stipulated that you're going to buy a simulator. How many have we got? 26 full cab simulators. Now, these are what we call full mission that you'd be familiar with. They do everything. They don't move. We had one motion simulator in the UK. Virgin Trains had that. They switched off the motion a little while ago. And we have 19 part cab simulators, which are full mission. They just don't have the full cab. I say 45 simulators delivered and operational. There is a tail to that. Not all are operational, and there are many reasons why they're not operational, which we may talk about later. By the end of this year, that's the amount of simulators we expect to see in the country. You can see on the left-hand side, those are the simulator manufacturers. Coris, French company, are the major player, followed by SIDAC from Australia. Now, SIDAC came into the rail industry about 6 years ago with a product that wasn't very good. And typical Aussies, they went back, took it to bits, rebuilt it, and now they are the most aggressive player in the UK and also in Europe. On my side, the left-hand side, or right-hand side as you're looking at it, those are the groups, okay, the franchisees within UK rail industry that own the simulators. And as you can see, funny old thing, Govia, which is a French group, have more than anybody else, and they're primarily Coris simulators. So why do we think that there's a lot of similarities, or are there a lot of similarities between aviation, military, and the railway? Well, it's a regulated environment. All those slides, you can see what they're saying. And I firmly believe this. Having been in both sides, there's a huge amount of cross-discipline where everybody is doing the same sort of job, but there is a key difference. And I'll come on to the key difference in a minute. That's the key difference. The management systems and the workforce are developing at different rates. In the rail industry, I believe we're probably 10 years behind where some of you are right now. Well, we were 10 years behind, perhaps maybe 5 years ago. We are accelerating. We're catching up rapidly. We've had to, because obviously the spotlight is on the railways an awful lot nowadays. This business about ethos and culture, it's very important to the railway. Similar to the military, okay? There is a black sense of humour in the railway, but there is a deep-seated culture in the railway of a family environment where you have several generations of people moving into the railway. It's those sort of cultures that support the railway, but they also sometimes are barriers because people get comfortable in the way they are doing things. They're not likely to change. We do things similar to a lot of other industries, systems approach to training. All the old documents on the railway, I say old, I think that one was 2000 or something. If you looked at the very back of this book, it would give you references to the Royal Navy version of training. We borrowed directly from the military. So when the military trains their things, eventually we caught up, and we started changing our documents. Roger and the people at RSSB are responsible for giving us documents which are now much more readable, much more usable. We carry out training needs analysis. Oh, do we? The rail industry embraces a lot of these terms. They don't fully understand them, and they don't apply them in the way that you might understand it. But we are catching up. When do we change our management systems? Similar to you, when we have a major equipment change, if regulations change, new training media. Well, I've just told you that actually what happened was most people got simulators and then had to decide how to use them. That created a huge delay. And the other problem that we have is that everybody in the rail industry are not using the simulators in the same way. We're not really cohesive. And that's what the simulator user group is all about. So we have similar management systems, similar needs for competence assessment, but we have similar consequences. Trains do kill people. On an average, we probably have 180 fatalities a year, mainly people who are committing suicide, obviously. But these are things that affect our drivers. So what are the differences? Expenditure. We have a franchise system, and we'll look at that in a little while. The franchise system drives our expenditure. It is extraordinarily competitive in the rail industry. We are all fighting with each other for the next franchise. Time and technology. Time on the railway, as I'm sure it is with you, but is very, very important to us. We have to justify why we'd want to take a driver off a productive turn of duty to give him some training. Are you telling me he's not currently competent? Why do you want to train him? These are the sort of attitudes that we have to try and work with. In terms of technology, we don't have the same amount of money to spend as you would on a flight simulator. So everything that we buy has to have a guaranteed return on the investment. The UK rail franchise system. Some of you may know how it works, some of you may not. It is a very, very competitive system. Nobody gets a franchise, usually, there's one or two exceptions, more than 7 to 10 years. Now, you can imagine what that happens is that we have a system where, for the first 3 years, there's lots of investment. The rest of the franchise is recouping that investment. So it does actually play a significant part in expenditure on training and assessment. We have a traditional workforce and management. Okay. Now, I'm being very kind about this. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with a traditional workforce and management. It's just that they can be a wee bit slow to change. And it is up to us as Just Culture champions to ensure that they understand that. They are the constant in our industry, the workforce. The franchises change. We need to win the support of the workforce and bring them along with us rather than trying to change the CEOs. Somebody on that table mentioned that this morning. What are we trying to achieve? Ideally, Justin and I would say we want to develop our drivers and ensure ongoing competence. Because of costs, because of time, because of all the other barriers, we are often in the job of just making sure we are compliant with the regulations. But the regulations are changing. The accountability, we want to try and give ownership back to our drivers, make our drivers responsible for their own competence. There is a difficulty with that in that the rail industry is regulated, but some of that regulation is being lost. And there's an awful lot of corporate responsibility going to come into the rail industry now, where the chairman of a certain group, the MD, the safety director, will be personally responsible for anything that goes wrong. We used to be able to say, oh, we are now compliant with group regulations. Therefore, that's our responsibility. We've lost that protection. And it means that everybody is looking over their shoulder to make sure things are done properly. Justin, was that quick enough?
Don't run away. You'll be glad to know Malcolm's back on a bit later.
Yes, that's the audience participation bit.
You're really important. I'll try not to bore you with my history. Joined the railway in 1992 as a driver. Still am a driver at heart, but for the last, or since around about 1997, been involved mainly with train crew management and train crew training. So I'm a guy that drives a train and tries to teach other people how to drive a train, as well as supporting the people that are out there to try and do it a little bit better to make their life a little bit easier. What button have I got to press, man? Ah, it works. Malcolm from the Sim User Group has already said that we don't have a standard consensus of how we use our 51 simulators. Some operators have chosen, or they've not reached an agreement with their trade union, to use their simulators for assessment. They're a training tool only. Some have almost stopped using them, as Malcolm's alluded to, completely. Others do use them for assessment. They use them for initial assessment only, not ongoing assessment, and they use them for compliance type assessment against basic rulebook standards. Some, possibly braver or more foolhardy operators, have chosen to use their sims to assess the new drivers and the existing driver workforce. When this has happened, and it's happened with myself and also with Malcolm up at ScotRail, what we've experienced is that our issues and challenges have been largely similar. Sometimes we allow errors to happen because on a simulator it's a safe environment. We believe it can be a powerful learning event. Needs to be debriefed afterwards. Often time constraints don't allow us to rerun the event. Others will stop the simulator prior to the error actually happening, sometimes through fear of what do we do if the guy does have a major error on the simulator. So we'll stop it prior, then we don't have to deal with it. But what we can do is explore the awareness of the driver and then rerun the event to make sure that they have learned from it. We say we have no industry standard or consensus, but there are some documentation out there. I've just picked two. One from our Office of Rail Regulation that now says that questioning an individual, which is a very historical method of assessment, should now not be used to infer competence because it's unreliable, especially for out-of-course situations. And we have some good work produced by Roger and Leslie and Andrew there, the team, with some good practice guide into simulators saying that is it a more predictive tool, but we still don't use them cohesively. Some of this is about barriers and challenges. when we sit down at the user group, we often talk about the issues that we've had, and the anecdotal information is largely the same. The driver's comments from all the way down in the heart of North London to some of the rural the rural lines up in ScotRail are the same. I don't know why I'm going to have to come and be assessed on a pretend train. It's not a real train, so it doesn't really matter. Probably the most common one there is that the driver will turn up and say, I don't want to be assessed. The simulator is a training tool only. It's not an assessment tool. These are the initial barriers that the drivers have, the expectations of the sim. Afterwards, that does tend to change. Afterwards, after they've had the event, and the event a lot of the time is unpracticed, so they will make a mistake, they've said, yes, I've learnt a lot. Yes, it has been the best place for me to come, do something that I wouldn't normally do, and learn from it. And probably the most common issue, common anecdote that they come out with is, it's not as bad as I thought it was going to be. The manager back in the line, when he gets this report, often accuses me, and accuses Malcolm, of deliberately tricking their driver. You've put them in an event where, they could do nothing else other than make a mistake. And if he'd been doing that on a real train, he wouldn't have done that. That's uncharacteristic of him. So these are some of the expectations that people approach the simulators with. I've said that the situation that we put them through can largely contribute to the error. Or we found that it can contribute to the error. Also, we can increase the opportunity of that error possibility by putting in duff information, by not giving them everything or not running it completely blue sky as it would be. We will get the hand signaler that's left the flags in the van, so don't know what to do. And these present challenges for the driver. So this is not just him being a passenger through the event. Also, people can come to it not prepared. It's only a game. I don't really see the importance of it. And also, we can pick up some lack of competence in the individual, where either the procedure, the rule, the regulation wasn't taught robustly initially. So we actually do identify some weaknesses. Other expectations we get, once the word gets out, because what the drivers love to do is what I call peer group information transfer. When they get back to the workplace, they like to shout about what's happened. This can lead to people coming to the simulator and giving a false reading. Talking to a few of you in the air industry, I think you've had this as well, that people will turn up and behave how they think we want them to behave. Sometimes that can also be prejudiced by the anxiety levels of this type of assessment. Also, the drivers will turn up. They've been told what to do back at the ranch. We have a TPWS procedure. Last year, we found that there was about a 90% failure rate when we put all our drivers through TPWS, that they weren't dealing with it as we would like them to do. We've rerun the event this year, and 90% of them now are dealing with it as we want them to. However, they don't understand why, because now we've got a learnt behaviour. This is generated by the peer group information transfer back at the ranch. They're pushing the button because someone back at the mess room has said, when you get to the simulator and you get TPWS activation, you've got to push the button. And then when we speak to them afterwards, why did you do it? I don't know. The bloke back in the mess room told me I had to do it. Maybe it was the passenger communication cord, but not the piece of safety equipment that activated. So these are some of the challenges we've come up against. What we've done at National Express East Anglia is just one of the initiatives in the rail industry. I'm not going to do the corporate slide, but I suppose we're about 10% of the national timetable with about 900 drivers. So, it's a fairly large core group. The simulators are integrated into the assessment process. The drivers have to come at least once a year as part of their license to drive a train. The assessment process itself is compliance based, so as long as you adhere to that list of tasks, standards, you tick the box. What we wanted to do though is work out the how. The how for me was very important. How a task is performed. And then the non-technical side of how the task was performed in relation to what it could lead to, sort of incidents and accidents. But the biggest challenge is how can we measure this? And how can we measure it in a meaningful, in a consistent way? Another issue is that when we have had errors on the simulator, there can be a historical punitive approach. There is a disclaimer, we do not treat drivers this way. I do not make them wear the dunce cap. This is one of the operators who volunteered, or probably voluntold, to do this. But errors can be an effective learning tool. They can also be seen as a precursor to, you know, to poor real-world performance. We like to record that. We like to keep that stamp on the record. You did this, just in case it ever comes back to haunt us. And that can breed the anxiety that I talked about earlier. You know, the drivers are then cautious. But what if I do make a mistake? Is this the one of the four ways someone talked about earlier, how to sack myself? So we wanted to look at errors. We wanted to learn about driver behaviour and try and identify it. I'm not a human factors expert. All I've done is read a few books, one of them written by a guy that was speaking up here earlier, or attempted to read it. So I got the experts in, and I made the call to the human factors team. They came along and helped us, as operators, identify the relevant non-technical skills. Now, these have always been with us in the rail industry. These have been the things that we have recruited and selected drivers for. These were termed as behavioural markers, key behavioural indicators of what makes a good and bad driver. And there's a range of selection tests to identify these. But we've never taken any further than initial recruitment and selection. So what we did with the team at RSSB, they came along, spoke to the subject matter experts, spoke to the simulator operators, and we tried to define some of these key behavioural markers into sort of operational tasks. You know, when someone is confident, assertive, conscientious, what does that really mean? What are we looking for them to do? So we started off with the key behavioural markers identified in the recruitment and selection. We looked at the actual what we want people to do and developed a non-technical skills toolkit. Here are just some brief examples. These were the observable behaviour that would satisfy that key behavioural indicator, that non-technical side. And then what we were able to do is design some of the simulator scenarios to elicit that type of behaviour. So there was a greater opportunity for someone here to, you know, have a systematic approach, to pay attention to detail, because there was a piece of detail missing or incorrect. So we were trying to elicit those types of things. That, again, earlier can be interpreted when the guy gets back to the ranches, we have set a trap for them. After we did that, what we found is that we were very unskilled in applying this, because we're operators. You know, we drive trains. We're not human factors experts. We assess a driver against a range of technical skills. So we've gone and trained the simulator operators, first of all on observing these key behaviours, and then on feeding them back. When they observe the key behaviour, it's just an indicator that needs to be confirmed or denied with the driver afterwards. And we have a structured feedback model that the operators go through, based around the sort of human information processing model, that comes into its own when the guy makes an error, or comes into its own when the guy does something really exceptional. And as an assessor, you get that gut feeling, this guy is good. But up to now, they haven't been able to have a body of words to put next to that. And what we're trying to do is define some of those bodies of words. So we've trained the operators, and we've done some exercises on consistency. Are people observing the same things, feeding back the same ways? We've done some of this with recording some of the runs, playing it to groups, and we're going to host an event where we're hopefully going to demonstrate some of this consistency at the next simulator user group.
I'm going to show you a small, short video. You can carry on, mate.
I'll be the monkey.
I'm going to show you a short video clip. It's about 3 minutes long. consider it. We will be asking you a question afterwards.
Jim, 12 hours, 26 minutes, and 15 seconds to go.
I know you're going on holiday, but there's no need to rub it in, you know.
Oh, Jim, see when they made you DTM, did they remove your personality, eh? I can't wait. Sun, sea...
Just pay attention out there. You're not on holiday yet.
I know that.
It's not just you, you know.
What do you mean?
You don't want to find out.
All right. See you later.
See you later.
Get the sun cream, or maybe I should get the sun oil this year, oil myself up. No, wait a minute, I mean that guy from Yoga did that last year, he ended up looking like Dale Winton on a bad day. Stick to the cream. That was close. Jim was right. Stop thinking about that bloody holiday.
He isn't a ScotRail driver, by the way. He's an actor, thankfully. He also took to driving a train in no time at all, which was really interesting as well. Took him about 10 minutes to master it. Anybody seen the Scottish sitcom, which is called Still Game? Well, he's actually the barman, or would be the barman. What we'd like you to do is, in the spirit of just culture, we want to consider a couple of things. I can tell you currently which one we would do in the rail industry. Okay? Show of hands for A, please. I should have said, yeah, all those not in the rail industry, please do not put your hand up. B? C?
Sorry, can I be ignorant for a minute, not being a train driver, what did he do wrong?
Right, yes, perhaps I suppose I better tell you that. In that instance, he didn't do anything wrong, except he should have been doing something about the fact that he was coming towards a red signal. Okay, he'd obviously allowed himself to be preoccupied with his holiday, and by the grace of God, the signal changed as he approached it. But we'll come on to that in a minute. So which one do you think, D, as I said, D. Anybody support D? C or D? It's interesting that you have an idea of which way you do it. The problem we have in the rail industry is that we haven't fully embraced the just culture yet. Okay? Have a little think about it now. The same video, the same situation, but ask yourself another question. How would you deal with it if the driver reported it, or if it was reported by externally, by somebody on the track, by a passenger? Would that change the way that you would deal with it? Now, some of the tools that we've learned this morning about how to adopt just culture and things like that are really useful to us in the rail industry, and we'll be looking into those. Ask yourself a further question. The consequences, had he passed that signal of danger, could have been a collision with a mainline train doing 100 miles an hour. Let's take that as a premise. So had he passed that signal of danger, that's what could have happened. Now ask yourself another question. Bearing in mind the fact that all the senior executives in the rail industry are now always looking behind their back, what about this question? So adopting a just culture isn't as easy as everybody makes it out. We have to bring everybody along with us. So a simple situation can actually lead to a different outcome. What I did like in one of the presentations earlier was the way that the degree of culpability changed as you went through it. That's something that I'm really interested in. I'm going to look into that with those people, because that is exactly what happens. There is an area where there is a line in the sand. It's defining the line in the sand for us in the rail industry that is the real challenge, and then passing it on, of course, to the workforce. We're not there yet, but we firmly believe in that's the direction we've got to go. Our biggest challenge is the fact that the franchises change on a regular basis, which means that the investment, the will to change things, is actually quite short term, because the higher management tends to be very short term. The only constant is the workforce, and it's the workforce that we have to ask to change their behaviours. There are probably aviators who could tell me what aircraft that is, and I know there are a few railway men here who have probably driven that one. Okay. So thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. You've recovered some time and nearly brought us in on time. We're now going to break for lunch. Lunch is up in the Argyle room, I believe, Rick. Is that right? Upstairs? Yep. We will reconvene after lunch at 20 past one, as timetabled. This will be a long lunch. But I just remind you that we do have the presentation from Captain Bundenberg in here at 10 to 1, and it will be as scheduled.